a good education than going to college. Uh-oh. Millennials are questioning if their large student debt was worth it, especially considering that 44% of recent college graduates are employed in jobs not requiring the degree that they got. 1 in 8 recent college grads is unemployed. Generation Z will explore education alternatives. So if you decide that you're going to have a university, like Cleveland State or whatever, if you decide you're going to have a university and you're not going to have online programs, or you're going to be lost in the wind. You know why? Because that's the direction of education. So when I teach an online class, you know, I'll have a student from Texas, from Houston, and somebody from somewhere else, and somebody from somewhere else, because we do that with our graduate programs, but we do very little of it at undergraduate. Well, that's probably going to change this next generation, too. There'll be probably fewer residential students, which really hurts the feelings of a lot of people that built those dorms. You know, because you built those dorms thinking that they're going to be occupied. But then if there are alternatives to education, for instance, like in the state of Tennessee right now, any resident in the state is guaranteed a 2-year education at a community college. But the last governor was considering making that a 4-year education. I don't know what the new governor is going to do. But the new governor also, Bill Lee, is very into teaching people skills. You know, he runs a 1,200-person business. I don't know anything about the business except that, I'm glad the campaign is over, and I'll be glad when the election is over, because apparently we're recounting. But anyway, the point with Bill Lee is that he wants people to have a skill even if they don't go to it. Listen, if you're a welder, you can make more than me for sure with a PhD in philosophy. If you're a welder, you can make more than me. You know, if you have certain skills like that, if you're an electrician, if you happen to be in one of those skilled areas, well, let me just tell you, you can make more than you can teaching at Fried-Hardeman. So I'm not saying that it's about money, but on the other hand, the new generation's considering new possibilities. And so, role hopping versus job hopping, 75% would be interested in a situation in which they could have multiple roles within one place of employment without jumping to another place of employment. They'd rather just do some upward shifting, or maybe even sometimes some parallel shifting, rather than actually leaving the company, 75% of them say. 58% of the adults worldwide, age 35 plus, agree that kids today have more in common with their global peers than they do with adults in their own country. Millennials were considered the first global generation. Well, we're going to expect more of that with Generation Z. So what about your relationship between them and organized religion as a whole? That means you and me. Well, that means that they usually say none. They're the none generation. That means, are you a member of this church or this church or this church or none of the above? And so they get the idea of nuns because they're often unchurched. Matter of fact, a third of them are unchurched. If Cleveland is like others this age group, they hadn't been to church in 6 months. Therefore, it is not that they are enemies of religion. It is not that they hate religion. It's just that they find it irrelevant, and they're apathetic toward it. Matter of fact, Matt Cook, whose office is right across from mine, is doing a PhD in missiology at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville. And one of the words that he's been taught in the reading that he has is that if you had to describe a generation with one word, like the millennials or the, you know, baby boomers or whatever, well, Gen Z would be apathy. Not about their work, but about church. They're apathetic about church. Do they hate the Church of Christ? Probably not. They wouldn't know enough about the Church of Christ to hate it. Do they hate other religions? Probably not. They're apathetic. You know, it's irrelevant. It's like getting that scam phone call on your phone. How long do you listen to it? Hello, my name is da-da-da-da. Oh, shut up. You know, and so what do? You just hang up on that person because you don't want to extend the warranty in your car again. All right, and so they get on there and you say, this is irrelevant. By the way, if any of you, do we have any telemarketers in here? Do we? Okay. I have even wondered if they are actually subhuman. Okay, you know, so I know that they're really humans and I know that they're doing their job. But how long does it take for you to say, I don't need this? Now, my wife will listen to them for a while because, I don't know, she gets bored. You know, she retired. And I don't know why. I don't listen to it. I just hang up. You know, I know it's probably somebody's son and somebody's daughter, but I don't have time to listen to this because they got my phone number when they shouldn't even have it. So that's what a lot of people are thinking about religion of this age group. It is just irrelevant. So the nuns indicate about 1 in 5 Americans now identify themselves as religiously unaffiliated, a group that would include those that would say they have no particular religion. Perhaps more instructive is a close look at the age breakdown. If you're under 30, there's a 1 in 3 chance, that's where I got that number, that religion plays little or no role in your life, according to this survey. 33% of them are saying this. All right, so barely half of millennials say they look to religion for guidance, but a higher percentage say they still pray. I mean, they still talk to God. Of those 18 to 34, you know, they are still spiritual to some extent, but they don't find their spirituality expressed in going to church, per se. The survey of 2,000 U.S. men and women ages 18 to 34 found that 62% say they still talk to God, but they ain't going to church. I mean, if you want to shoot marbles on the interstate, try Sunday morning, you know, because there ain't near as much traffic on Sunday morning as there is every other day of the week. Well, where are they going? Well, they're going to a lot of places. Most of them are not going to church. So, what do we do? Well, we have to understand the filtering process here. I put some, you know, air filters of automobiles and stuff on the left, but in case people couldn't relate to that, I put some coffee filters on the right. Okay, so what do I mean by this filtering thing? Well, you are a part of your culture whether or not you are aware of it. And usually you are most acting out what your culture says in matters like this when you don't even think about it. I drank my last glass of sweet tea in September of 1997 because I had a doctor who said to me that they were producing my kidney stones. I didn't like kidney stones. And so I said to myself, you know, I guess I'll give this up. I did give it up. You know how hard that is? I drank sweet tea for breakfast. You know why? Because it's 3 times a day. How many of you drink sweet tea? Hands up. Okay, and the important thing that Northerners don't understand about sweet tea is what? What do they not understand? You don't put sugar in unsweet tea and call it sweet tea after it's gotten cool. You know, you don't do that. That means that you are from the North if you do that. What you have to do is put it in there while it's hot and let the sugar dissolve so that it's thick enough that you can either drink it or lick it. You know, and so because that is part of our culture. Now, for those of you from this area who are UT fans, I'm a UT graduate as well. That was the place where I got my last degree. I love it when UT does well. But 2 Sundays ago, I was preaching in Tuscaloosa. Now, you want to talk about a strain on spirituality. It was for me to be preaching in Tuscaloosa. And there was, you know, because I love Alabama people. Are you from Alabama in here? Hands up. Okay, you can now close your ears for just a minute. All right, what I said to them in Tuscaloosa 2 weeks ago, I said, look, I love brothers and sisters in Alabama. I just don't like you when we play football. Okay, can I just say that that's part of the culture is that I would like to see us be competitive again? Maybe we can. Who knows? Nick Saban won't live forever. All right, and so there was Tide for Christ. There was Tide for Christ over there, and they're very active in the church and bringing others to the Lord. And so it was a really good thing. But part of my culture is that this is how I feel about football. Matter of fact, my wife, who was born in Mississippi, is a bigger Vols fan than I am. I mean, we have the dog that, you know, when you push the button and stuff. All right, so is it part of your culture? Yes. All right, so that's part of the filter through which things have to pass. Now, here we are in the South. What does that mean in Cleveland, Tennessee? Well, I don't know your culture well enough. I know it involves Little Debbie's and M&M's. I don't know your culture well enough to really understand what the people here are like and how they think. But that's up to the elders and deacons and preachers to figure that out. Matter of fact, if you want the church to grow, then probably your target group is not going to be my age. Now, you'll get some converts my age and older, but that's not going to be your target group. Why, somebody? It's time to talk. Why is my age not going to be the target group for most of your evangelism?
That's not the demographic that's growing.
That's not the demographic where I'm going to get most of my converts. And what is the demographic where I'm going to get most converts?
Gen Z.
These guys right here. Millennials and Gen Z, they're it. If you give up on them, you're giving up on a generation of people because you might occasionally baptize somebody who is old at a nursing home. You might occasionally do it at a rehab center. You might even do it in a jail where somebody is a lifer and been there a long time. You might occasionally do that, and that'd be a great thing if you can bring them to the Lord. I'm not saying that's not a great thing, but I'm saying that's not the target group. The target group has to be this group right here, and that means that you have to understand or try to come better understanding how they think. So whether one calls it postmodernism, post-Christian, post-denominational, almost everybody knows that the climate in religion has changed since 1973. I graduated from 1971. So it's difficult to define, Millard Erickson said. He's a big evangelical scholar. Yet everybody knows there's something that different that's gone on, although it might be difficult for us to put a precise definition on it. I became interested in this in 1994. It's not a recent interest, because I was asked to do some lectures with two other guys, Randy Harris and James Walters, at Harding Graduate School in Memphis, on the subject of postmodernism and hermeneutics. When I knew what hermeneutics was, I just didn't know what postmodernism was. So I started reading and reading and reading in 1994 to get ready for this discussion. Matter of fact, with the help of other people, I read more than 2,000 pages worth of stuff to try to figure out what's going on here, what's going on here, what's going on here. And why does the group that you are in influence the way you interpret the Bible? That's it. The group that you're in kind of has a relationship to how you interpret the Bible. Now, for those of us who are older, we're pretty solid on the restoration movement. You know, that's the way we have been taught to think, and that's the way we think. What are we supposed to be doing? We're supposed to be restoring the New Testament church. And the way that we do that is by going back to the pattern and by doing what the pattern says. I had a Bible when I came here. But you go back to the pattern and you do what the Bible says, and therefore you restore the church. That approach means nothing to this new generation because they have not bought into it. I asked one of my senior level Bible majors class, can you name 6 restoration leaders from the 1800s in the United States? They could not do it. My class could not do it. I kind of grew up on Barton W. Stone and Raccoon John Smith and Alexander Campbell and Thomas Campbell and those others. But a lot of people saying, I never heard that stuff. Nor does it really matter to me, those people in this country that were trying to restore the church, because I'm more interested in trying to find my way to Jesus, and therefore the thinking is just different. If you want a gospel meeting where you're almost guaranteed not to have millennials, just say, we're going to talk about restoring New Testament Christianity. Because they wouldn't know. It'd be like asking Ralph to restore a Chinese manuscript. Now, why can I not restore a Chinese manuscript? I can't read Chinese. If you ask this age group, now, which church is closest to the Bible? The problem is that they don't have enough theological background to know which one is closer. They just know that if they go here, they felt welcomed, they felt like that it was a fit, and they will go to church here. A lot of these millennials will not search the scripture, nor did a lot our age, will not search the scripture to try to see which one is closest to the New Testament. That is not the way they will do it. They will put on a shirt or a blouse, and if it feels good, if it looks good, and they can afford it, and they want it, they buy it. But they don't research anything about it. You know, you get in a car, and it feels good, and it goes vroom, vroom. You know, then, you know, you buy it if you can afford it. And if you can't afford it, I guess you don't buy it. But the point is that you don't buy cars, most of them, by doing careful research of the company. You know, Volkswagen, I know, is north of Chattanooga, just past the exit a while ago. And do you do research on cars to see which is the best one, or do you get the one that you think you can afford, and boom, there it is. The sons of Issachar, tell me, Ryan, when it's time to quit. Sons of Issachar, men who understood the times with knowledge of what Israel should do. Their chiefs were 200, and all the kinsmen were at their command. So whenever I was asked to do this, this is what occurred to me. If you want to do this as a congregation, if you choose to, you got to first understand the times. And then you got to try to figure out, now, what does God want us to do? Try to understand the times, and then try to figure out, what does God want you to do? There are 3 ways to respond to cultural change, and it really has changed, and it's still changing. Why? Every time somebody invents some new technology, it's going to change. So you can go off the cliff either way, to the left or the right. The middle ground is going to be hard to get. You can do everything in the world to bring people to Christ, and the Bible means nothing. I mean, whenever you hear big television preachers misquoting the Bible, not knowing where a scripture is, or whenever you hear a big name preacher like, you know, Rob Bell saying that there is no hell, and Jesus talked more about hell than any other person who walked the earth. You know, if you say, guys, you know, have you even seen the movie about the Bible? I mean, have you ever actually studied it? And here you are preaching to a congregation of 20,000 people. And so the first thing is, what are you willing to do to get people? And that's the one first approach. I'm going to do everything that I can think of. We're going to do a dog and pony show if we have to. We're going to do the bells and whistles. We're going to do everything. Whatever it is that we're big enough to do, we are going to do it because we are going to grow this church. Well, that's one extreme. The other extreme is, I don't have to do anything. Congregation has been here for many years. It'll be here for many more. We don't have to worry about it. Have you been to Church of Christ recently where there's an auditorium that'll seat 1,200 people and they have 200 people there? Have you been to one of those? In Dallas, in Memphis, in Nashville, where they used to have 1,200 people and now they have two? Have you been to one of those churches where they have maybe 100 people on Wednesday night and 600 people on Sunday morning? Have you been to one of those? And you say, wow, well, what do they say? Well, I'm going to hold on to my double knit suit until it comes back in. I'm going to hold on to my double wide tie, covers more stomach. Okay, I'm going to hold on to it until it comes back in. Because eventually, you know, culture is going to come back around. Well, it might. It might be a while. And what's going to happen to us in the meantime? I'm of the age that I'm starting to think about, you know, this kind of stuff. Especially when your kids, you try to say to your kids, okay, what do you want after we die? Now, we don't want you to push us in the grave. But the point is, okay, and then your daughters are usually congenial until you talk about this. Okay, and then it's like, say, what do you want, you know, from us, you know, and how does all that work? I've seen so much fussing and fighting after somebody dies over material things. We certainly don't want that to happen in our family because we ain't got no material. I've taught at Freed Hardeman for 37 years. All right, in the middle, you can say, I'm going to do something about this. Now, there's words for this. If you decide you want to do nothing, this is called cultural overhang. And this is also going to kill you. Why? Because eventually, you're going to start having a couple of funerals a week. And the older people, those of us that are older, are going to be dying out. And there's nobody in the middle. And what's going to happen when that happens? So, you could do nothing. And just hope that it's going to get better. And I don't think so. I don't think that's going to work. You can do anything, and that's called syncretism. When you try to mix together oil and water. There are some parts of Texas where drug lords have become patron saints of the Catholic Church. Drug lords have become patron saints in the Catholic Church. Because apparently some think it'll add legitimacy to pushing drugs if we make them high up in the Catholic Church. And so whenever, I'm not saying the Catholic Church would do that here. I'm talking about some parts of Mexico. Do you hear this way if you understand what I'm saying? Okay, and so are you willing to do anything to get members? Let's just legalize everything, you know, in order to do that. Well, I think that you can see that what we're striving to talk about today is contextualization. Ryan, how much time I got? Contextualization means I'm taking something, and let's say I started this psalm book over here to the extreme left, and passed it to every person in here until the last guy on the right got it. Notice how many times it has changed contexts. From one person to the next is a contextual change. Now the point would be, if that young man over here started it and this man over here ended it, the question would be, is it the same songbook? Well, I don't need any physicists in here to start counting molecules, but what I want to know is it the same songbook? What would you say, guys? If it started over here and came to you and you received it last, is it the same songbook? You would say no? Well, maybe I'm saying it wrong, but what I'm wanting you to say is it's the same book. I mean, it's the same one that had these characteristics. And even though it's got some more DNA on it, you know, from each of you touching it, but it's still essentially the same book that it was. Now, what am I saying here? Can you do that with a church? Where do y'all have mission work here? Somebody tell me where you support mission work here. Where? In New Zealand. Who do you support? I love Ken O'Donnell. He's a friend. Okay, and I've been there a couple of times myself and have knocked on doors. So Kent is solid. I love him. Are you trying to set up an American church in New Zealand? Well, why? Why don't you just want to set up an American Church of Christ in New Zealand? Well, why? They're not American. And it's not an American Church of Christ to start with unless we messed it up. We do not want there to be an American Church of Christ in New Zealand. We want there to be a Church of Christ in New Zealand. And that means somebody's got to decide what is it that it is necessary for the church to be the church when I move it from one context to the next. Because New Zealanders are wonderful people, but they don't speak English like you. And they don't even say 14 like you. 14. You know, they're going to say it a lot differently. Wonderful people over there, and I love them. But they're going to do some things differently in the church because their culture is different. But do they have all the essential stuff right? That's what contextualization is. Do you have the essential stuff right? In the same way, going to Tanzania, been there 3 or 4 times, and whenever you go there, do you want to set up an American church? No. You want to set up a church. That is the one that's in the Bible. By the way, I buy into the restoration movement to the extent to which they follow the Bible. But it's not them that I buy into, it's the Bible. It's the Bible. Now, the same thing would be true other places, any other place where you have mission work, that's your ideal. I was in Grants Pass, Oregon 3 weeks ago, and there's probably 70 churches of Christ in the entire state. They got 4.5 million people. And most churches of Christ are small. And it's a mission work in Oregon. So it's not like around here where you can throw a rock in just about any direction and hit a church of Christ. Matter of fact, East Tennessee doesn't have as many as West Tennessee. Or some in some parts of Middle Tennessee. So what do you do? You're going to try to contextualize. And when you contextualize, that means, okay, what does that look like in this context here? Okay, the first is isolationism. I don't want us to do that. Why? That's sticking your head in the sand, hoping that everything will go away. Just kind of hoping that you're going to open your eyes. And there is no Panera Bread. And there is no Starbucks or Chipotle or whatever. You know, that it's just going to kind of go away. Another thing this generation doesn't do much of is buffets. Can you tell I like buffets? You know, and a lot of this generation doesn't, some of them do, but a lot of them, they don't want to go to a buffet. They'd rather go to a place where their portions are monitored so that they will not overeat like they would at a buffet. We got stuck in West Palm Beach because our car place is a long story. It was closed and we couldn't get our car. So we had to wait at a Whole Foods place in Fort Lauderdale last weekend for the local preacher to come to pick us up because the car that we rented, the car was the, I won't tell you that, who I rented from, but it starts with a B. Okay, so, but you know, they didn't have our car. And so here we are at a Whole Foods, and I'm looking at all the skinny people coming in and out of Whole Foods. Why? Well, because, you know, they buy carefully. They also pay a lot for it. But nonetheless, they buy carefully at Whole Foods. All right, so the first extreme would be this. Second extreme would be do everything. Don't do that. It's wound up in the emergent church movement, the emergent village. And it's very difficult to see how some of these are even kind of kin to anything that the Bible would say. But nonetheless, there are some people like Dan Kimball who are more thoughtful in their analysis of the situation. And here's what he says people think about the church today. In his book, they like Jesus, but not the church. Number one, and quickly, number one, the church is an organized religion with a political agenda, and this generation hates for you to mix religion and politics. And a lot of us just got through doing it. Number two, the church is judgmental and negative. Number three, the church is dominated by males and oppresses females. Number four, the church is homophobic. We talked about that the last time that I was here. Number five, the church arrogantly claims all other religions are wrong. And number six, the church is full of fundamentalists who take the whole Bible literally, and that's not the way that many in this generation think they should do it. So this is from Kimball's book. Because of time, I'm just going to refer you to a book. I don't even have time to review this because I got too much material. I'm going to refer you to this book if you want to read a short book about this generation. It's called Zombies, Football, and the Gospel. And it's talking about how this church in Georgia, who are fairly conservative, they're not one of us, but fairly conservative religiously, how they've built a church of 30,000 people. Again, it's not size that we're talking about, but it's faithfulness to God's word. So I guess it's time for me to quit. And if you want a copy of this, it's on the church computer. And if there's somebody here who can be designated to give it to you, you can study it for yourself and see what you think. Because I'm not telling you what to think. I'm here discussing a topic that your eldership is interested in. And it doesn't mean that there's going to be people jumping over seats and handling snakes and stuff. Does not mean that there's going to be an instrumental music. Does not mean there's going to be a woman preacher. It does mean, is there something that we can do to reach this generation without going too far? Is there some way to do that? Thank you.